Thanks. We're girls, so we have tiny little voices. So welcome to Hacking Cybersecurity. Today we'll be talking about a very timely issue since cybersecurity has been prevalent in the media. So today, this afternoon, we're going to try and get through a lot of the hype and try to come to a conclusion about what is cybersecurity, what is hacking, what are the major threats to security, and how we can effectively address those threats. My name is Stephanie Margosian. I'm COO of a digital public affairs firm in San Francisco called Real Polytech. I'm also a partner at Gagne Margosian, an internet startup law firm. I'm joined today by three very esteemed panelists, Christina Gagne, Sarah Granger, and Louisa Williams, and I will let them give a little introduction for themselves, tell you a little bit about themselves.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. My name is Christina Gagne. I am the partner who focuses in internet, intellectual property, and technology at Gagne Margosian. Today, I want to focus on a couple things with cybersecurity, and first and foremost is the lack of legal framework to deal with it. One thing that we've noticed in our practice is, you know, cybersecurity means a lot of things, but when we have to get down to brass tacks and talk to people about what are the laws that exist around it, what do we have to comply with, there is an absence of an infrastructure. And that becomes more important when it comes to hackers. I mean, first and foremost, what is a hacker? What is hacking? Good versus bad hacking? I mean, this is a conversation that is not playing out in the media right now. We just see instances of, you know, security being compromised, and then we see a lot of sort of blowback from that in the media. But we don't have definitions around these things, and maybe that doesn't matter in sort of the layman sense, but it definitely matters in the legal sense. We don't have an infrastructure for dealing with hacking that might actually jeopardize national security. There's a couple of bills that are circulating right now in the Senate that deal with some of these issues. The White House has a cybersecurity proposal, and there are some pieces that you can weave together through different laws that currently exist. But there is an issue that, you know, if something were to happen, how would the U.S. treat a domestic threat? How would the U.S. treat an international threat when it comes to hacking? And so these are things that, you know, are being discussed right now in the Senate, but there's really not a conclusion in terms of how companies have to comply with cybersecurity policies if there was a national cybersecurity policy, and then also how we're going to treat individuals. And so I hope to talk a little bit more about that later today. But this kind of fits into the larger corpus of there not really being a lot of internet-related law. I mean, this plays out in the social media field as well. So thank you for coming, and I hope to provide more perspective on the legal aspect of this.
I'm Sarah Granger. I recently founded the Center for Technology, Media, and Society, and I work on a lot of policy and interdisciplinary issues around how technology is changing the world, including the security aspects. I actually first went online at age 9. I think I attempted my first hack at probably age 10. I was using bulletin board systems on my computer, and you know, I just knew basic programming, and so I couldn't really do much damage. I was just poking around, but that gave me the beginnings of an insight of why do people start hacking. And one of the issues that I have dealt with over the years is, you know, what drives hackers? And so I started thinking about these issues early on as I learned more about programming and then became a system administrator. And then I had a friend who actually got arrested for freaking. Everybody know what freaking is? In the late 80s. And so he went to jail for that, and this was at the very beginning of when people were starting to, when they were starting to have criminal law for these offenses. And that was one of those things that really got me started to think about cybersecurity, which, of course, wasn't called that back then, and how it really is changing everything. And now all of our computers, all of our systems, we've got everything on financial networks, military, everything's dependent on computers, and so we have these, what used to be seemingly innocuous hacks have become a lot more critical to our thinking about, you know, how we stay secure. And so what I spent a lot of time thinking about is how how we can balance openness and security, because they're not necessarily opposing issues. And I work on some of the policy aspects in that respect. But one of the things that I wanted to sort of speak to a little bit is really, you know, how hackers are motivated, and I guess we're going to get into that a little bit later. But I think it's very important to realize that not all hackers are bad, and there is a way we can provide a really good conversational framework around how to work within these communities to learn more about our security and to improve it also with working with them.
Hi, I'm Lavisa Williams. I'm here from the government. I'm here to talk to you about what the Department of State has been doing in terms of use of social media. So I am sort of more the practitioner side of things. So really talking about, you know, what does security mean when we're actually using it in online communities? My focus is predominantly on public engagement, so not necessarily government-to-government kind of communications, but government-to-citizen communications. How do we protect people's data? What do we think about privacy, First Amendment rights issues? Especially in my case, we're talking about not just domestic issues, but we're talking about global issues. Where does security and current policy meet, and where do they potentially have problems, where we have to think about addressing some of the behavioral issues that we talk about we want to use because they meet the business requirements that we have, and yet maintaining a way to preserve the data that we have that is sensitive and protecting, perhaps in some cases, loss of life issues that we have as we're using social media globally for, in my case, diplomacy, any form of diplomacy that we're doing. I specifically work in an office that's called the Office of Innovative Engagement, and we function sort of as an internal consulting company. So we help embassies and consulates figure out how do you leverage these technologies? How do you do it in an effective and responsible way? So security is not something that we think of as the first thing or the last thing. It's interwoven into everything that we do. So we provide guidance, we provide training, and we help our embassies ultimately be successful in the use of social media. So for this panel, I'll be really thinking and talking mostly from the perspective of being a community manager. What are their responsibilities? How do they handle some of these security issues that they may come in contact with, whether it be a hacker or impersonation of government officials, or perhaps the willingness to try and defraud Americans or even just the general public when it comes to applying for services with the U.S. government.
Thank you, ladies, for those introductions. So there has been recently a robust debate around cybersecurity, and I think part of the reason why this debate has been so robust is that we still lack definitions about very basic terms, such as cybersecurity and hacking, that we don't necessarily have a framework for the conversation where we can all kind of start at a basic level. So during this conversation, let's start with defining some of those basic terms. So let's start with, you know, what does cybersecurity mean to you? Christina, why don't we start with you, since as a resident lawyer, you're all about definitions. Can you give us a little bit of a framework to start off with?
Well, that made my job sound a little boring, but yes, I am all about definitions and complying with definitions. So cybersecurity means several things. One, let's talk about in the corporate context. You know, many companies face cybersecurity threats. So if you're a startup and you're collecting location data, that system gets compromised, you have a cybersecurity threat. We've seen many breaches over the last year and a half. Sony, I think, comes to mind as something that really stands out to me, which is with the PlayStation Network. People were using it. It's an entertainment system. It seems like an innocuous thing to use. People have fun with it. all of a sudden data was roaming free that people didn't expect to have roaming free. And so in that context, you know, Sony had the way that they dealt with that, which apparently was, oh, I keep leaning on this, I apologize, to give people a free game for their violation of security and privacy. But that being said, that's a corporate example. You know, on the government end of things, we have a variety of things that have happened over the last couple months that I think sort of illustrate the spectrum. That's what I'm going to talk about today in terms of hacking, is there's a spectrum of, you know, hacking and what happens, you know, what's bad and what's good. One example might be, you know, the CIA website getting hacked or the FBI website and maybe something funny being put on it or a couple words being changed. You know, there's a debate, is that compromising cybersecurity or national security? On the other end of that, about a week and a half ago, the Jet Propulsion Laboratories were hacked into. And so NASA obviously was concerned about this happening because it affects sort of the prowess of the United States and sort of how we're going to move forward with the space programs. And so this spectrum really sort of shows the different elements of cybersecurity on a government perspective. Lastly, there's the individual perspective. And so by trade, I'm a privacy and copyright attorney. And so for the individual, cybersecurity implicates First Amendment. And so if you want to proceed anonymously online, whether you're actually blogging or maybe you use hacking as a way to demonstrate your opinions, I think that with Occupy Wall Street and all that's been happening over the last couple months, you know, that has become prevalent. So that's also implicating cybersecurity. And so I think we have to think about it from the corporate, the government, and the individual perspective, and the legal frameworks have to also match up to that as well. And so I think that we don't have clarity in any of those three areas.
Does anybody else have any thoughts on that issue, Sarah?
Well, I just wanted to say that if anybody's read Cyber War by Richard Clarke, he had an interesting definition of cyberspace, which obviously is a little different than William Gibson's, but it really was the point, he made the point that it's not just computers that are hooked up to the internet, it's anything, any system that is involved in our daily lives is part of cyberspace. And so when you think about cybersecurity, I always go back to the technical, you know, I have a technical picture in my head of what the internet looks like and what the nodes and the wires and wireless routers and things like that. But the reality is that anything that's connected to any of these systems is a part of this. And we are at a point where there is no real separation anymore. If there is any kind of military attack, computers are going to be involved. And so that's why the DOD is getting so involved in a lot of these issues and concerned about them for good reason, particularly when you're talking about critical infrastructure. And then on the financial side, which is, interestingly enough, where even though I work with a lot of national security people, the financial side tends to be where most people think of cybersecurity. And, you know, the FBI, that's really what they spend more of their time worrying about is the financial systems getting broken into or financial data being stolen because it is such a huge problem with credit card theft and identity theft and that sort of thing. So that's another thing to think about.
Lavisa, as a community manager, what is your perspective on cybersecurity?
So a lot of what we do in terms of cybersecurity is actually handled by our diplomatic security. So they're the people who are out there, and they're actually changing what they're doing. So there's a policy called the NIST 80-53, and it's currently going under revision. And originally it was focused on, you know, kind of a reporting, very kind of reactive sort of way about talking about cybersecurity issues and securing our systems and our infrastructure. And they're now changing that to be focused in a much more proactive way on what's actually happening out there. How can we get real-time reporting to ensure that there aren't vulnerabilities in places that we could potentially be addressing them? So it's a very different approach for us, and it sounds like a little change, but for government, it takes a long time for us to change. So making that kind of a change on how we're thinking about security is definitely going to have an interesting impact on how we move forward on the kinds of threats. But we also are seeing an increased number of threats against our networks and our data.
I like the way Christina was saying, how she framed the conversation, I think. We're talking about the individual, we're talking about corporations, and we're talking about government. I think that really kind of sums up all the issues that come under this banner, cybersecurity. So let's start talking about the individual. Let's start talking about the individual hacker. That's another kind of buzzword that's out there, but is loosely defined. Sarah, as our resident, I guess, hacker on the panel, how would you define what a hacker is? And, you know, can you make a distinction? We talked about, and Christina mentioned some of the more innocuous things that hackers do versus some of the bad things, I guess, you would categorize as hackers do. Can you make that distinction? Or, you know, is there no differentiation to make?
Well, there's this book called The Hacker Dictionary, and it has actually 8 different definitions for the word hacker. And the original definition was, there's another great book, I'm going to be mentioning a lot of great books because I think it's always interesting to have good resources come out of sessions. But Stephen Levy wrote the book Hackers, and it was really about the beginning of the people who were hackers coding, writing DOS, and, you know, the foundations of our modern operating systems. And the first hackers were really just coders. So we've got those kind of people who are still considering themselves hackers. And we've got the open source community that sprouted out of that. And even when the ARPANET was first invented, it was mostly about open source, and they didn't think about security as much. It was about information sharing. So that's why we find ourselves in a situation now where it's harder to secure it, because it was never designed to be what it is today. And so you've got those kinds of hackers. And then you've got the deviant, you know, mm-hmm. hackers that maybe motivated by ego or malice or whatever, and they're traditionally more crackers was what they used to be called. Now that's the term that everyone thinks of as hackers. So we have to just sort of assume that if people are talking about hackers, that's really what they're talking about at this point. And those people can be motivated by money. They can be mercenary hackers at this point. There are lots of groups of hackers. Military classifies advanced persistent threats, APTs, of course, because they like their acronyms, as these groups that are usually non-state actors that are paid hackers, either like Russian or Chinese or whatever. And those are the ones that we really have to worry about. Mm-hmm. You know, versus the high school kid that's just trying to break into the, you know, CIA or whatever and change a couple words. So there's a lot of different distinctions, but today I think the ones to worry about are the highly trained hackers and the people who are not motivated by civic pride, like, for example, the hacktivists are. Mm-hmm.
Well, from a legal perspective, there's obviously issues in defining individuals and communities and the activities that they take place in. And so they're, in terms of hacker, you know, people even use the word hacker today. You know, people, you hack around any kind of system. Like, let's say, you know, you jump a line to go to a concert. You've hacked around standing in the line. I mean, just the word is being thrown about so much that, you know, it's sort of losing some meaning in terms of the public. And unfortunately, when the public gets up in arms about things, you know, sometimes things can be miscommunicated. From a legal perspective, the conversation got scary for me over the last year when, you know, that we were talking to, whether it was government officials or people that, you know, were parts of companies whose data had been compromised, was hackers are terrorists. I was like, are you really creating that right now? Like, yeah. That's where the conversation went. And that does mean something in a legal sense. I mean, if we're going to use words like that and then create legislation where, you know, we're implementing things like you would for a terrorist in terms of criminal penalties, civil penalties, well, criminal penalties for terrorism, but civil penalties for other crimes, that's very scary. And so if we don't have a clear definition of what's okay and what's not, that's a problem. And an issue of that right now is that we don't have, and this is sort of in the legal world, you know, we don't have a lot of precedent for this. And so we don't know how to deal with these situations. And, you know, these threats have been around for a while, but how we classify them is really important. Second, there's a difference between what happens domestically and internationally. And so, you know, one of the things, if you go back to, and I'm a foreign policy nerd, you know, the non-state actor. And there's a lot of examples of that. But this would be a non-state actor if they were a threat. And so from an international law perspective, there's really no way to deal with this right now either. And so, there is a need for rules, but me being sort of an anti-regulatory person, just because the government and sort of how they deal with things, by the government I mean Congress, there's a lack of understanding of the community. There's a lack of understanding of what it includes. And so there's a big education process that has to happen both on the government level with Congress, and then also on the individual level.
Right. And so we have a little bit of a framework about who we're talking about. Let's take a step back and talk about the what again, specifically threats. In terms of, corporations, let's talk about what you would identify as the biggest threat to enterprise, to big business in terms of cybersecurity. I don't know who might want to start with that, Christina or Sarah.
Well, I think obviously financial data is a big one, and the attacks we saw last summer was indicative of that with Citigroup and some of the others. And what I worry about, it also, I think, intertwines with national security a lot, because if our financial systems are crippled to a certain extent, then it becomes a critical national security issue if the economy starts to fail. Mm-hmm. So the good thing is most of the big financial companies are pretty well secured compared to some of the critical infrastructure, like electric grid and things like that. So I think that is the main issue. But when you've got smaller companies, then you've got a real problem, because you can't afford real good security. And a lot of the time, even medium-sized companies will opt out of doing smart computer security practices because they know it's expensive. And then they end up having to pay more to deal with a serious break-in.
The instance I'm interested in, and I sort of have two opinions about this, is I love the health tech community that's emerging. I mean, there's so much cool stuff happening in terms of using mobile applications to facilitate personal managed healthcare. I've seen it's a positive thing that the healthcare industry is starting to move in towards more of a social health direction. At the same time, amassing that much data about people can be scary. I mean, I can think of sort of biological warfare implications in terms of someone hacking into a system, getting a bunch of data, and attacking a population. So for me, those are very exciting startups and sort of things that are happening in that space. But health information is a big threat. I think also, one of the things that's been discussed in terms of sort of even healthcare reform is, when companies know about your health history or they know things they normally wouldn't have access to, how they treat you. So, we might even be facilitating sort of cybersecurity brokerage where people are able to hack into people's healthcare information and then sort of use it against them. And so these are things that I think we have to think about. At the same time, I would agree for our financial systems. We've seen the implications of when the finance system does us wrong, but I think we can also see the implications of when someone does wrong to the finance infrastructure, what that might mean for all of us in terms of bank accounts and other personal finances.
I would actually say, for a community management perspective and from, having worked in government for a very long time, this kind of emergence of everyone having all these mobile devices on them that are as smart as some of the computers that we have, whether it be a smartphone or a tablet PC or something like that, they're just as convenient to diplomats as they are to all of us as consumers. And what that means is we're doing more and more of our business out in the public mobily. So we're not necessarily chained at our desks. And what does that mean? We want access to all of our resources where it is that we are, on the devices that we use. And, government being as it isn't necessarily always using the most latest, greatest form of technology, because we're trying to maintain a configuration that is secure. And it's not to say that we can't make smartphones and tablet PCs secure, but it takes us a long time to put that policy in place. So we restrict people from using it, but it doesn't mean that our people still aren't out there and still wanting to do it. And in fact, I think about the Canadian who came through the Canadian border, and he had on his iPad his passport, and he actually thought that maybe he would be able to get into the country based on that. And that was sort of a big wake-up call to us because it said, oh, wow, the public is expecting us to start using these technologies and being able to accept this these kinds of transactions in a secure way. And right now, we don't have a way to facilitate that. As our people start using these tools more and more for business, it means that we have less control over that data, and we don't know what's happening with it or where is it going. And that's a concern. I don't know that we necessarily have answers on how to address all of that right away at this point.
I think the question of control is an interesting one because as we're talking about corporations and the threats that arise in the cybersecurity space, when a threat arises, a need arises, and that need needs to be addressed by somebody. And so now we have a cadre of security professionals that specialize in cybersecurity. And I think the question comes up, well, it's great to have them around protecting us. They're still humans. And the question comes up, these people have all the skill and all this information. What if they're doing something outside of their professional lives that can harm us? What is the implication there? That's just kind of a general question for the panel, okay. So anybody who wants to pick it up.
I think that comes back to, and the same thing happens in the social media space, is, work time versus non-work time. But also, there's been several instances where we've had hackers that were parts of, security organizations, like advocacy organizations, like Protect People's Privacy, Protect People's Data. Then all of a sudden they're arrested for hacking systems. I think the Irish hacker that was just arrested, that was the instance. And so, that is scary, but that could happen in a variety of contexts. I think public education is just part of it. And then also, I think having frameworks, having frames of reference that we can deal with these things.
I'm going to come out with another book recommendation. It's called Kingpin by Kevin Paulson, and it's a, I think, mostly true story of a hacker who started out as sort of a rogue, innocuous hacker, and then he became a white hat hacker for the government, I think, as a consultant, and then eventually turned to the dark side and started stealing credit card numbers. And it's a really good example of how that can happen and what kind of communities there are for hacking now, because this book just came out last year, and so it's a lot more modern than some of the other hacking books out there. But it shows you sort of what goes into the thinking behind that sort of attack mentality. And a couple of the other interesting things that came through that book were that, a lot of these people in these hacker networks are actually sort of double agents. Like, they hack themselves, but then they also inform on the other hackers because there isn't necessarily a big sense of loyalty in some of these people. And then the other interesting thing was that a lot of the hackers are not actually trying to make tons of money doing it. They're just trying to live a normal sort of middle-class income with their hacking and maintain that, but because it's illegal activity, it's just this weird universe that they have to live in order to try and do that. It would obviously be much easier for them to just go mainstream and get a job as a computer programmer, but once they get sort of down that path, it's hard to turn around.
So from an internal perspective, in terms of employees using these kind of new technologies, we actually talked about, do we need a policy that says what you can do in your official capacity and your personal capacity, and where do you draw that line? And the problem is it varies for everybody. We personally, how we think about privacy is very different from the person perhaps sitting next to us or the person that comes from another culture. And so we purposely said that we weren't necessarily going to try and draw that line in a policy perspective of, this is what you can do in your personal capacity, this is what you can do in your professional capacity, and this is how you do that. Instead, what we try to do is teach our people how to make smart decisions. So we provide them with do-it-yourself resources that help them figure out how do I set up an account for Facebook if I'm running that as a community manager for the U.S. government? How, if I am in my personal capacity and I have a Facebook page, how do I protect myself then? Because although I'm not acting as an official for the Department of State or for the U.S. government, I can still potentially be targeted for my role in the government. By people who are perhaps looking to have negative things happen to us. So you know, we want to make sure that those people are aware of how do they protect themselves and their data when it's online, and how do they represent themselves in the public, as, both in their personal and professional use. So we'll never say you cannot use social media. You cannot use these other emerging technology tools. What we prefer to do is, yes, you can use them, and here's how to do it in a way that will make sense and protect not only you, but also the interests of the government as well.
So, Lavisa, as a community manager, you deal a lot with human behavior, and that raises a lot of issues in terms of security and protecting people's privacy and their safety. How do you manage all of that with, you know, all these people online, engaging with the government, engaging with each other? How does your department, the Department of State, manage cybersecurity issues and balance out the engagement part of it?
So one of the ways we do that is through some of the training that we were talking about. So we do provide formal training for people who are using social media as community managers. We also have a number of different resources available to them. We do have a help desk. It is not 24/7, although we're working in a 24/7 environment. So we try to make those resources as user-friendly as possible, so they don't necessarily need us all the time. But hopefully, if they follow some of those resources, they will be in compliance with all of the current policy, the best practices that are happening out there, both commercially and in government, as well as addressing the security issues that would go along with the use of that specific tool or platform. We also have a community manager boot camp that we have put some people through. It's sort of a new thing that we've been working on to get people more aware of how do you do crisis communications. For us, you know, some of these things could be considered a crisis. So I think good planning and good strategy and having that in place are some of those keys to success, because the more you actively talk about these issues and address them within that community, I think the easier it will be. We also have a standard terms of use that includes rules of conduct for the community. So everyone, we're as transparent as we can be to those community members about what is acceptable within those communities. How do we manage those communities? What kind of content will we take down if we need to? And we really don't want to take down content is the rule.
I think also what's interesting about your position at the Department of State is that you have to intimately think about the issue of identity all the time.
Right.
And how people are managing their identities online, and what you have to do in order to kind of maybe protect them from themselves sometimes.
Right.
So, you know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, there's been a big discussion. We've heard it from Google. We hear it from Facebook about you should be your real self online. And they say, well, that's the only way you can really connect with people. This is, you know, there's no need to hide from anyone. You know, this is a safe, perfect little world, right? unfortunately, we all know that that's not really true. The only way you can be safe is not putting anything online. And I almost think that that's impossible at this point, because even if you're not doing it, your friend or somebody else is doing it for you. So managing that, what's already out there, is probably a good idea. But in the meantime, we're looking at various ways to address some of these community manager issues. And one of the main things that we do in some of the training is that we say, we recognize, for instance, that most of the world does not have any kind of how to be safe online training. Mm-hmm. We as Americans, we get kind of inundated with a lot of that information that's out there. Other countries have different perceptions of privacy. They know that the government knows everything about them. So they say, why do I have to worry about protecting myself? They already know it all. But they're just as susceptible to, you know, predators, sexual predators, people trying to do identity theft, as well as other kinds of things that could happen to them online. And so one of the things we ask our community managers to do is just do a periodic training and kind of, you know, public service announcement, if you want to say that, about how to be safe online and encourage people to protect themselves. We do have situations, obviously, I mean, because we do cover over 260 locations globally, where not every government is necessarily thinks kindly upon having, or their citizens having, a relationship with the U.S. government. therefore that host country government could potentially target those people in ways that it could have bad consequences. And so we want to make sure that they understand, those users in our communities, that we respect the fact that they should think about how to be safe online and how to protect their identity when they have those conversations with us. Because for us, it's more important to hear those ideas and opinions than for us to actually know who you are.
And just to jump in from sort of a definitional perspective about anonymity and talk about the First Amendment and other things. So there's a reason anonymous is called anonymous. There's a reason that people have handles and things online. They don't want to be identified. And this can be tied back to the First Amendment. I mean, we have a robust tradition in this country of people being able to express their political opinions and do it anonymously. And so, you know, this is now just playing out in the hacker world. I mean, this is the things are being done that are forms of political expression. And, you know, so saying hacking is wrong or we're going to have penalties for hacking when there wouldn't be penalties for me standing out with a sign on the corner necessarily unless, you know, I was disrupting something or, you know, sort of how First Amendment law works, this is an issue. And so one of the things that needs to be focused on in the hackerspace in terms of how we treat hackers is due process. I mean, we have laws in multiple fields about due process. You know, we have rules and penalties. So this is what qualifies in terms of a criminal, you know, violation. And then if you violate the law, you get due process. And then we decide what the penalties are. We haven't had that conversation around cybersecurity. The legal framework that exists right now and the emerging one is really about how do I go to the government and get information surrounding, or how does the government go to a corporation and get information surrendered. So there's a couple of pieces of legislation in the Senate right now. One is more about self-regulation. So, you know, hey, companies, like, you should self-regulate and give the government data about hackers. And that's a Secure IT Act. And then there's also Senate Bill 2105, which is basically companies, you have to give people up and this is how we want you to do it. Well, this is all focused on the individual is bad. The individual is a bad actor. And so you give us data about the individual. And so we're already creating this framework where no matter what you do online, it's bad, whether you're voicing a political opinion about a company because they're wronging people in various ways, or, you know, whether you are actually maybe hacking in and, you know, giving out data, whatever the case may be, we're putting it all in the same bucket with these pieces of legislation, and that's really scary. And this comes back to the larger technology debate that's happening in Congress around privacy. There's a lack of understanding of what goes on in the community. There's a big divide between Silicon Valley and D.C., and I think that the hacking debate is the same thing. People don't understand that some people, hacking is, I hate this term, but hacktivism. I mean, they're using hacking to make a political point. That's very different from, I'm stealing a bunch of credit card numbers, and then I'm hurting people financially. So making those distinctions is important. As of right now, we have a very disintermediated system of dealing with computer fraud. So, for example, there's a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that deals with hacking in terms of, you know, using a computer to defraud somebody. We have policies under the Department of Defense that if you do something that compromises defense strategy, like there's up to 10 years of imprisonment from an old law from 96. We have to update these laws. We have to make sure that we have a new legal framework. It's just kind of scary that, you know, we're sitting here having a conversation about this. None of us have a seat in Congress that I know of. So, you know, it's just a little scary. And so I think that this is something that as a community, we have to rally the public around to really understand how this works and then hopefully have like a legislative solution that isn't just at its base criminalizing people. You know, and I don't mean in the sense of they're having to go through courts, but we're just, hacking has now been criminalized. I mean, we just sort of don't think about the positive aspects of it. And as someone who attended my first hacker conference, I went to Black Hat last year, there's a spectrum of people doing awesome things out there that could be considered hacking. And so I think that we have to kind of change that public conversation.
I think, Christina, you bring up a really good point. I mean, we here in this room and here at this conference are the privileged few who understand these issues and who can, you know, really talk about them in an intelligent way. But the broad base of, you know, our society here has no idea really what's at the core of these issues. And a lot of those people, you know, sit in seats of power. A lot of those people, you know, right for the media. So how that brings up the question, I think our final point before we throw it to questions in the audience, you know, how do we educate the public effectively about these issues? How do we educate them effectively about cybersecurity and who hackers are and what their role is in kind of our tech ecosystem here?
There are a number of things that I would recommend in this area. One of them is for people who are technical to get involved in on the policy side or the activism side or issues side. So you can join an organization. The simple thing is to join an organization like the EFF or CDT and to actually keep involved and informed on what's going on in terms of these issues. And then you can write letters to your congressman and actually tell them, hey, you know, this is a good idea or a bad idea. If you really want to get involved, I have been on a committee for a long time in the Association for Computing Machinery. We're the largest organization of computing professionals in the world, about 100,000 members, I think. And we have a U.S. public policy committee, and we have gotten to the point now that we work enough with staffers and legislators in Washington that they will listen to our input on the legislation. And so we are purely technical, nonpartisan. All of our feedback on this legislation is from a technical perspective because there are so few people in these positions, particularly in Congress, with technology backgrounds. And so that's really important. And then the other thing really is for more people with technology backgrounds to go and serve in public office, either as appointed or elected officials. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as more digital natives get to the age where they can run for office. But it's very important for the discourse to have people engaged at every level. And then in terms of other education, you know, I write a lot. And I think anyone who can write to these issues, start blogging, write in mainstream publications and magazines, places where people are not as technical, get your points or your ideas across, and that I think is also a really good way of doing it. And then just teaching people in your own lives, you know, we all have to deal with tech support with our parents, right? So, you know, think of it as for the greater good, just, you know, every step that you take educating somebody else about, you know, how the internet really works and what's actually at stake, and particularly just simple things like why they need to change their password. It's so mundane to us, but it's really important for them because otherwise they'll end up sending some virus to you and all right. 25 of the people on their email list or whatever, and that gets irritating to everyone. And then the other thing also is to remember, I try to really encourage people to remember social engineering is also a form of hacking, and it's in many ways much easier because the human part is always the weakest link in the security structure, and so it's easier to pretend you're somebody and go ask for their password than it is to figure out which holes are in their, you know, that particular Windows box and try and infiltrate them. So educating people about social engineering, I think, is also very, very key.
One thing I want to focus on, and I would love if I had a judge who'd been a hacker, because I have judges that don't even know how to use computers, so it would be a welcome change. Jargon. We're stuck with jargon, and the same thing happened with the net neutrality issue. What the hell is net neutrality? Like, that was really the question. And so I think the same thing here is, you know, we don't know what hacking is. Cybersecurity is a term that just sounds scary, and so people just sort of head for the hills when they hear it. Creating terms, communication points that really are salient with people. And we do have to worry about the middle of the country, so I feel that sometimes we just sort of are D.C., San Francisco, L.A., maybe Boulder, but throw, you know, them in there for the tech community, but we don't think about sort of what the average person thinks. This just sounds scary. Like, all of this just sounds scary. If you read an article in Time magazine about it, it just sounds scary. When in reality, this is a multifaceted issue. So I think that developing communication points, and I think, you know, SOPA is a good example of that. There were so many people that rallied around, you know, that piece of legislation and being, you know, whether they were for or against it, you know, and we saw some change, and the same thing happened in the decency space, you know, about 10 years before. So we have to break through the jargon. As an attorney, I battle with that every day, but I think that if we're able to do that and communicate, so back to Sarah's point about communication, that's important. Most importantly, though, is the technical expertise in this room would be sort of a wealth of information for Congress and for staffers, and so, you know, even if what you, you know, even if you are a hacker, even explaining, like, what you do and why you do it, you know, those are things that would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree with sort of everything the rest of my
panelists have said, you know, in regards to training and really getting involved. And it's not necessarily just at the congressional level. I mean, you can do it at a much more local level, because, I mean, when you start talking about influencing Congress or your local politicians, sometimes that's kind of intimidating. But just like reminding people when you see them in your office or in your personal life about, you know, locking your computer when you walk away from it, making sure that your virus definitions are up to date. I mean, all those little things make a difference. And reminding people about, you know, by the way, Facebook just changed all their privacy settings again. Not only should you check them once, maybe you should check them three times. Being aware of what kind of data that you're putting out there and recognizing that really anything out there is, could be used against you, and people that you may not know may actually have access to that. Always good reminders.
The other thing, I heard a statistic the other day that surprised me, that only 5% of corporate CFOs are actually involved in network security at any level. So, you know, just educating people within the companies you work for, I think, is also very important.
I think, Sarah, the point that you brought up, the literacy issue, is really important. I mean, we do take for granted that we have, you know, a very basic level of technical skill, but some people in our lives don't, but they're using the technology anyways. So I think, yes, you know, teaching your grandmother how to use email correctly or, you know, to avoid passing along viruses and things like that is something that's overlooked but important. So now you guys have heard from us, and we want this to be a conversation, so we'd like to hear from you. So we'd like to start taking questions from the audience, and we're going to be passing around a mic. So if you can speak into the mic. We have a question up here, right up here in front.
Hi. First, I wanted to thank you all for coming and presenting on this topic. I think it's very important right now, and also it's wonderful to see the composition of the panel. Thank you for your informed perspectives. I wanted to give us a chance to talk about an event or issue that seems to hit at the confluence of all of this here fairly recently, which is the arrest of this so-called leadership of the LulzSec security group. Just to frame that conversation in terms of perspective that I think is very interesting, my understanding is that Sabu, this self-declared leader in some sense, was arrested back in June, became a cooperating witness with the FBI immediately thereafter, and basically since that time has been in some sense definitely tapped in, as the FBI has as well, to the point where they're observing all of the chat logs that have gone on between his conversations with anyone he's been engaged with, but also more so than that in terms of actually providing information to compromise systems to hackers within that community and space, even going so far as to provide server resources in the case of the Stratfor hack owned by the FBI to work with the management of those emails that were subsequently then, at someone's suggestion, released to WikiLeaks. And so there's a lot of conversation going on about whether this is entrapment in that sense, and whether there has been an attempt in some sense to kind of beat the cybersecurity or cyber war drum in this case. So I just wanted to open this up for our conversation.
Well, I think from a legal perspective, we're missing the case law necessary. I mean, entrapment, for example, there's laws around entrapment, and then we have cases over the years that sort of define what is entrapment, and there's different situations. I think the technology is a barrier here in terms of the fact that people don't understand that the way the technology is being used, specifically by the FBI, that this could be a form of entrapment. I also think there is an ethics issue that pops up, and, you know, many communities have ethics, and so, you know, there's things that we learn as, you know, a larger internet community about ethics and things that we do or don't do to each other online. You know, the same thing in terms of, you know, hackers, like, are there ethics in place? I mean, if somebody does, you know, get arrested or something happens, you know, obviously in any criminal context, there's an advantage to being a cooperating witness. But when you're dealing with technology and a network of people that have been using technology together to engage in an activity, I think the stakes get much higher. And so I think, one, our federal approach in terms of criminal law needs to refocus on systems and how the FBI can do things. And that might come in terms of some of the communication acts that exist in terms of storage, or just sort of going back to sort of how we approach things from a Fourth Amendment sense. And I think that that's a conversation that won't happen for a little while because we're still stuck on sort of the traditional warrant context. So I think getting there is going to take a little while. That being said, I think it's a combination of ethics and then a combination of tactics in terms of how the FBI does things and our understanding of what they're doing. And a lot of people don't even know about that situation. I know because I've been like following this very intimately, but a lot of people just aren't aware that's happening, and I think they'd be appalled.
Yeah, and I think this is an example of something that's going to happen more until there are clear laws around it. And we've got other recent examples like the GPS tracking devices on cars, and that was finally dealt with. And now we also have the issue in terms of international law and cyber war, where what is a preemptive attack? A lot of these preemptive attacks are going to start happening, like Stuxnet, for example, and that's a really gray area in terms of military law, which is not any of our areas. But I think issues like these are just going to keep cropping up. And I know with WikiLeaks and all that, that was a big issue too in terms of classified and unclassified, and there's just so many places where there is no precedent. So, it's going to be, I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be, this is all going to be pretty big stuff we have to deal with. And I'm guessing Congress won't actually respond with any real legislation for probably another 10 years that deals with what's going on now, since they're only trying to deal now with what we've been dealing with for the last 20.
Yes.
We have time for a couple more questions. Anybody has?
My question is for Sarah, and it's just simply, what does your organization do? I don't know if you touched on that.
Yeah, well, we're new, and what we're trying to do is approach the some more of the interdisciplinary topics that aren't covered by other organizations in the existing space of tech policy, for example. So looking at, if you look at cybersecurity, what's not being done by these other organizations, where can we look at that and combine with open government, for example, and how can we create open systems for secure information in that space? We're working on issues of like gender and new media, for example, like there aren't enough women represented in Wikipedia. And then also one of the big areas that that has been seen more in disability communities or parent communities is the flexible workplace. But it's also a technology issue, and we have all these great technology tools to deal with it. So we're working on in some of these areas that maybe aren't touched on by existing tech policy organizations, and trying to raise awareness around them. And we're just getting started, so we haven't done a whole lot yet in that area, but we're looking forward to it. Thanks for asking.
Any other questions?
There's one right over here.
So just curious if you have a take on a combination of what you've talked about here and the fact we've got this whole population of digital divide where they don't even, like we have, and we're talking digital divide from the socioeconomic point of view as opposed from the geographical point of view. So the idea that you've got a whole generation that's fairly illiterate, and you're talking about a pretty high level of literacy here. Is there anything out there that they're doing as far as policy, as far as laws, as far as anything along those lines to address that? Like, for instance, if you're going to have something that has a digital divide addressing capability, all of that security is already built in.
Do you mean in terms of products or programs, just to clarify?
Programs. I'm looking at, I guess, more from if you're aware of anything on the nonprofit side, because that's really who's addressing the issues here and how the approach is. Are they integrating the security piece in what they're doing in the nonprofit world and how?
Yeah, well, this is going to sound a bit self-promotional, but my other hat is that I run a project at the California State Library called Job Scout. And just to give a little background, is the idea of the platform is that there's so many people coming into the libraries across the country that don't know how to use computers. And so they're coming in to find jobs and do a bunch of other activities. So how do you teach people how to use the internet, how to use the internet, and then how to do something using the internet, in this context, jobs? Part of the lesson framework there, and it was requested, which is great, was privacy and security. So, for example, now we taught you how to use Facebook. Cool, you're using it. But back to the comments we were making earlier, are you using it correctly? Are you putting your settings down when you're sending emails? Do you understand when you get that email from, you know, someone in Rwanda, like, doing something, like, they understand that that is spam, for example. So I think that some programs that are approaching digital literacy are trying to also teach about privacy and cybersecurity. But there's also issues of cultural competencies. Lovisa addressed those earlier in some of her comments. We all have different understandings of privacy and what it means, what we will share and won't share. And so I think what will be interesting is how projects like the one I'm working on and other projects in this space, how do we address that? And I think additionally, and this comes up a lot, is in the policy space, is convincing people who are potentially on the other end of the digital divide. You know, we're trying to convince them, hey, you should use technology. Like, we don't want you to miss out. We want you to be a part of this larger community. But also then communicating the importance of these other issues. So cybersecurity, or, you know, explaining to, like, my grandmother, like, why SOPA was a big deal. I mean, you know, it just doesn't affect her everyday life. So those are some challenges that we pose. But I'm hoping that more organizations and even potentially the AARP can take a lead on sort of giving primers to people about why this stuff is important.
We actually do for our RFPs that we put out for contractors and for our grants that we put out, we do, and we're actually adding more language to this, but we do have that part of the requirements for getting the grant or doing work on behalf of the federal government requires you to adhere to our security policies and other policies that we have in place. We're starting to add in more language that would cover things like cybersecurity issues, privacy issues, and especially, you know, social media and emerging technology and the use of those tools.
It's a really good question, by the way. I know of all these different organizations working on digital divide overseas, but I can't honestly recall any of them that put security in their primary framework. I mean, maybe they also do it with some of their trainings, but I don't know. I would check out Digital Democracy if you haven't. Yeah.
Well, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. It looks like we're just about out of time. Thank you very much for coming to our panel. And if you have the panelists will stick around for a little while. So if you have additional questions for them, please feel free to come up and chat with them for a little while.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm Christina. Nice to meet you.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I agree with you as far as the AARP's possible role on consumer reports.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Hi. Depends on which, what part of state and what are you looking for specifically.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Let's not give you somebody else's card.
Yeah, just what the first is that you've heard about, or general, or itself, or...
Right. So diplomatic security does most of that work. There's a couple different divisions. As I said, it sort of depends on what angle you're trying to look at. I'm happy to put you in contact with some of those people so that you can give you a virtual intro.
In the Bay Area, and know a lot of the EFF
and then they'll be happy to help you with that. There's always contracts out on the street looking for people to help us do a lot of that work. So, because unfortunately, like any good government and agency, we don't necessarily have these skills in-house. So we're always looking for people to try and help us figure out how to do it better.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks,
you're welcome. Thank you.
Next month.
Hi.
NIH.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I've seen you on the list several times.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, are you guys doing any kind of internal social networking?
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
Yes, we are.
This is like a big.
It's kind of wacky. We have an office called Office of E-Diplomacy, and they really work on all of our intranet issues. And so, and they're responsible for all internal tools. We have communities of practice that have been in existence for quite a while, and they're fairly popular. We also have Wikipedia. We have a version of Wikipedia that we call Diplopedia. That's really essentially our wiki site, but it's very formalized. So it's not as organic as we would like, and we think we've actually plateaued with that. We're also looking at, we have an internal crowdsourcing platform that we use as ideation tool called IdeaScale. Then we also have just recently launched sort of an internal Facebook, which we call Corridor.
Are you, what are you using
I think it's Drupal, isn't it? Drupal. The Corridor?
Well, and there are some good things.
It's Drupal-based, and then they customized a whole bunch of stuff for it.
There needs to be something done with the problem.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is I haven't really seen it take off.
How do we get these companies to actually report use?
And we don't love it. Like, it's bad if we don't love it.
Yeah.
I'll give you a card, too. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
So Sammy works with me at State.
Hi.
Hi. I'm with
Okay.
I was just I've been trying to talk to you about
For sure. I'm here till Wednesday. Here's my card, though, and that's my direct.
Yeah, there's a ton of, like, DOD is a huge user
just,
of it.
Text me, tweet me, like,
and I, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah,
if
I work
it's
in,
a cultural issue or what at
well,
State,
so
but it's also bad, like, when neither of us on the internal side who are doing social media and we are the social media office for all intents and purposes, we don't love it. Like, we're like, why would you do it? You just use Twitter.
So that's sort of.
Right, there's no value added.
He's like mentioning things, and I'm like, yeah, it's all I'm reading about right now. I'm like, I feel like I know these guys. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's a big issue.
But we have internal light,
You know, every couple of years, we decided to focus on a community and declare war on things, like the war on terror. I'm like, I'm just imagining this war on hacking being declared. I'm like, we don't even know what it is.
So Veronica's at the National
and
Defense University.
I mean, within the privacy space, I mean, it's been all these blow-ups with companies like Facebook that have pushed companies to adopt
it. Oh, yeah, I'm at it. Because I'm the co-chair for the sub-council for social media. So
I don't know, it's just
I'm helping to coordinate a lot of the social media content for the annual conference.
Yeah.
You should. I don't know.
I'm just ping me.
Do it anyway. Send it to Sheila Campbell. Just to see. Because our big thing was that we really wanted, and we told them this, we're like, we now are to a point where we have government employees who are smarter about this stuff in a lot of cases than the vendors. And we understand the environment that we're in and the policy kind of regulatory issues that we have to work around. And so therefore, we prefer where possible to use government employees employees to talk about these things. And so we made a strong case, and I don't know if GSA will take it or not, but that we really wanted to use internal government people to talk about social media. And we tried to propose like a lot of that kind of stuff, but for various reasons, they decided that I think they backed us down to like 2 or 3 sessions. And there's like we could have just done a full day of just social media and government. I mean, we have that much content, and we're seeing trends on various things like analytics, like hardcore community management crisis community issues.
Share information,
right? And overcoming the cultural issues, and then also experimenting with new and emerging technologies. How do you do it in the right way? How do you establish that culture of innovation that's the lifeblood for the organization?
My training. So, So my background is I'm piracy sharing,
and we've done all that stuff.
And the industry,
and in fact, we do consultations for other agencies. So if you ever want to use this for something, or you want to get us in front of your other people. Maybe it's your senior management or some other middle managers or whatever. I know. And that's what we hear really hard about a lot. It's sort of a pay it forward model. It's not the hoarding of information is power, it's the sharing of information is power. And it's a huge, significant cultural shift for any government agency. And especially when you add in, like for your case in NIH, where you're a highly regularized agency, it becomes more difficult because you have our roles that we all have to abide by. Plus, it's a wee bit challenging. Yeah, exactly.
Does anybody want?
Nice to see you too. Sheila Campbell. Yeah. So she's the chair for the conference, and she's kind of making those decision points about what's up and how's that working. So. Or not. I don't know how finalized they are on the schedule yet, so she'll be better able to tell you that. But we are trying, GSA is really big on tools, so they're talking about running what we call under the hood sessions, which focus on specific tool or technology and just to like, down and dirty, how do you do it? And how do you do it well? And we wanted to do much more of just a straight broadcasting kind of thing. We really wanted you to bring in whatever problem it was that you had. Like, let's say you didn't know how to use new timeline function in Facebook, that you could actually come in and sit down with someone and learn how to do it the right way, or maybe from a way that's much more aesthetically pleasing so that you could build a better community kind of thing. GSA kind of pushed back on that and are much more focused on the actual functioning of the tool versus us bringing the actually help you kind of thing. So we're like, that's not really what we wanted, but we're not in charge. So we're like, all right.
Because of the piracy, we could maybe one of the big piracy sources out. Taming that down a little bit. They wouldn't.
So that's what the under the hood wanted to be. They were supposed to be running concurrently with all the other sessions, but they now decide they didn't want to do that because they thought it was too much competition. I actually think that's not true. I actually think it'd be extremely valuable.
No problem.
I know. But they're still very website focused. And they've kind of not made that transition to social, and they haven't learned how to balance like traditional website kind of stuff with social, and how those are different. I mean, a lot of people still think that just because there's a URL, therefore it's the same thing, and they should be treated the same way, and they're in fact two completely different animals.
I'm glad you came out.